The CIA says the Saudi government was behind the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but Trump needs more evidence. Clashes between protesters and police in Athens and the future of Brexit. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI Evening News for Saturday, November 17th, 2018. The Trump administration on Saturday said it had not reached a final conclusion on who was involved in the death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, despite a U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessment that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters that Trump on Saturday discussed the CIA assessment by phone with the agency's director, Gina Haspel, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. A source familiar with the CIA's assessment said it was based largely on circumstantial evidence related to the prince's central role in running the Saudi government. Greek police clashed with young protesters in central Athens on Saturday after thousands marched to mark the anniversary of a violently quashed student uprising in 1973 to help topple the military junta. More than 10,000 demonstrators marched peacefully through the center of Athens, which was heavily guarded by police. They held banners reading resistance and chanted slogans related to Greece's 8-year debt crisis that led to 3 international bailouts in exchange for deep austerity cuts. The procession ended at the embassy of the United States, which many Greeks accuse of having supported the 1967 to 1974 7-year military dictatorship. Meanwhile, British police said they arrested more than 70 people at an environmental protest on Saturday in London after demonstrators blocked 5 bridges across the River Thames. Organizers of the Extinction Rebellion's event said they wanted to put pressure on Britain's government to take greater action to slow climate change and eliminate greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. Hundreds of people protested near Westminster carrying banners with messages including "Stop Climate Breakdown," "Fossil Fuel Era Over," and "Rebel for Life." Organizers said more than 6,000 people had been involved. The United States will not back down from its trade dispute with China and might even double its tariffs unless Beijing bows to U.S. demands. That's according to Vice President Mike Pence in a bluntly worded speech at an Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation or APEC summit in Papua New Guinea. Pence threw down the gauntlet to China on trade and security in the region. He said, "We have taken decisive action to address our imbalance with China." He declared, "We put tariffs on $250 billion in Chinese goods, and we could more than double that number." The United States, though, will not change course until China changes its way, he said. The stark warning will likely be unwelcome news to financial markets, which had hoped for a thaw in the Sino-U.S. dispute and perhaps even some sort of deal at a G20 meeting later this month in Argentina. United States President Donald Trump, who is not attending the APEC meeting, is due to meet Chinese President Xi Jinping in Argentina. In more international news, Irish Foreign Minister said on Saturday that pro-Brexit British ministers are not living in the real world if they think they can renegotiate the divorce treaty agreed with the EU last week. The withdrawal treaty would not be reopened and suggested that wavering British ministers instead seek to influence the political declaration on future relations still under discussion. Diplomats and officials involved in Friday's meeting told Reuters that EU states said they wanted an ambitious future relationship with Britain, but this would not mean what they call frictionless trade. And Theresa May's hopes of securing her Brexit deal were dealt a new blow on Saturday night as the EU warned the UK would have to pay about £10 billion, which is about $15 billion, more to Brussels to win extra time for a smooth exit. Ahead of what Downing Street said was a critical week for the Prime Minister, Cabinet ministers also piled on the pressure by publicly insisting that she change the proposals. As the Prime Minister tries to prevent a coup by hardline Brexiters, determined to oust her in a vote of no confidence, she will hold talks with EU leaders through the week ahead of a Brussels summit next Sunday. May had reassured conservatives that the so-called backstop that could keep Britain tied in a customs union with the EU will never be needed. The latest poll delivers more bad news for May, with Labour opening up a 3-point lead. It shows anti-Brexit supporters appearing to desert May's party in droves. May took questions before a contentious meeting of Parliament on the issue Friday night.
We can choose to leave with no deal, we can risk no Brexit at all, or we can choose... Or we can choose to unite and support the best deal that can be negotiated. This deal, a deal that ends free movement, takes back control of our borders, laws and money, delivers a free trade area for goods with zero tariffs, leaves the common agricultural policy and the common fisheries policy, delivers an independent foreign and defence policy, while retaining the continued security cooperation to keep our people safe, maintains shared commitments to high standards, protects jobs, honours the integrity of our United Kingdom, and delivers the Brexit the British people voted for. I choose to deliver for the British people. I choose to do what is in our national interest, and I commend this statement to the House.
But Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn took issue with May's plans for Brexit. He says that under May's plan, a full Brexit may not happen for years.
The withdrawal agreement is a leap in the dark, an ill-defined deal by a never-defined date. Yeah. There is no mention of the Prime Minister's favoured term, implementation period, anywhere in the 585 pages of this document. And no wonder. There is precious little new to implement spelt out in either the agreement or the political declaration. Article 3 of the agreement states transition can be extended to end by 31st of December 20XX. Can the Prime Minister confirm that this permits extensions to be rolled on until 2099? Can the Prime Minister confirm that if the UK government cannot agree a comprehensive future relationship by January 2021, which few believe would be possible, and the last 2 years gives us no confidence this government can, then those negotiations would have to be put on hold? Because the focus would then inevitably shift from negotiations on the future relationship to the negotiations on an extension of the transition period, including further payments to the EU. Article 132 sets out this process fairly clearly. So can the Prime Minister firstly tell the House how confident she is that a deal can be done by the end of 2020, and also confirm that if a new trade agreement is not agreed by the 31st December 2020, then Article 132 applies, paying a huge financial contribution in order to extend the transition period, if we are to avoid triggering the backstop, as the Prime Minister insists is her position.
Economist and investigative reporter James Henry says the internal bickering over leadership of the Conservative Party in the UK is really what's driving the debate.
Brexit is a case of buyer's regret. I think the latest poll out shows that, you know, if they had it to do over again, 54% of British voters would would vote to stay in the EU and roll it back. It's become this gigantic kind of kabuki theater going on mainly in the Conservative Party between May, who's trying to split the difference. She has a lot of opponents who are just in favor of cold Brexit, just complete walking out of the EU rather than trying to negotiate a deal. And some of them are people like this guy Rees-Mogg, who's quite extreme libertarian type, the former foreign minister as well. And they have ambitions to displace her as a party leader. On the other end, there's, you know, some realists who are saying the Brexit that we've negotiated with the EU is actually going to make things a lot worse for many banks and core sectors of the British economy. Is going to complicate trade with the continent, which, you know, the EU still accounts for an enormous share of British trade and commerce and investment. So I think the financial sector, the City of London, has been up in arms about trying to stay in the EU, and huge sector for the British economy, and it looks like they're losing the battle. So the difficult thing is that the Labour Party in Britain is also divided, and at this point there's still a substantial reluctance on the part of the party leader to basically oppose May on this issue and to say that we ought to stay in the EU, because I think he's recognizing there are quite a few people within the Labour Party that are quite critical of remaining in the EU as well. So outside of observers, I think, are really ready for this debate, which has been going on now for 2 years, to end. And there's increasing evidence that the original vote was heavily swayed by the UKIP party's use of Facebook and Cambridge Analytica kind of intervention tools to manipulate the vote. And if you look at the actual history of the popular sentiments about Brexit, there's this 3 or 4 day period during the vote back in, you know, right around the time of the referendum in May, when for that just that few days the vote tipped in favor of leaving, and then it went back to opposition. So it's a long debate, and it's not anywhere nearly concluded. It's still up in the air. What's going to happen to this half-baked deal that she's done?
What's going to happen on March 29th, in your opinion, when it's supposed to be one way or the other, they're going to be out of it?
If reason prevails, I think it's a little bit too late to expect them to have another referendum here, and you know that's not likely to happen. Reason prevails, they're probably going to adopt something like what she's come up with. It's not ideal, but at this point it looks like, unless there's a leadership contest and she's tossed out, this is probably the best they're going to be able to do. And they've gone around the barn on issues like Northern Ireland and the difficulties that having a new kind of set of barriers to crossing the border with Ireland, because Ireland's going to remain in the EU, would make. And, you know, sort of, there are, 10,000 issues that had to be negotiated. They underestimated substantially all of the fine print that had to be dealt with here. But I think more fundamentally, they have this position within the party that's charged with negotiating this this deal, which is fundamentally in a leadership battle at the same time that they are, you know, trying to negotiate this these terms. So my friends on the continent are just aghast and sort of waiting for this to be over, because it's really holding up investments, cross-border investments throughout Europe, and this is not a good time for that, because the world economy is really struggling to take the next step. We have a lot of signs that stock markets are basically peaking, that the most of the forecasts for economic growth or for a leveling at most or a downturn in the economy in the next couple of years. So, you know, this is probably the worst possible timing that you could have for the British economy to be going through this kind of constitutional debate.
Meanwhile, the United States economy has been far outpacing Britain and most other countries throughout the world, but there are growing signs of a fallback in the U.S. economy beginning next year. The chair of the Federal Reserve is Jerome Powell. He says trade is the engine of the world economy, and a continuing battle between major economies can hurt everyone.
If all of the tariffs that have been announced are applied, what would be the effect at the aggregate level? And they're still relatively small. We worry about a couple of things. One is loss of business confidence, which could reduce investment. Again, we don't really see effects that we can measure yet. Also, the possibility of a financial market reaction over time to unexpected trade developments. More than anything, though, I would worry in the longer run where this is going. You know, if the end place we get to is lower tariffs, that would be good. You know, trade generally supports productivity, supports higher incomes. And fair trade under internationally accepted rules can be a good thing. I think if this perhaps inadvertently goes to a place where we have widespread tariffs that remain in place for a long time, a more protectionist world, that's going to be bad for the United States economy and for American workers and families and also for other economies.
Economist James Henry says a simmering trade war with China, the fall in oil prices, and a weak stock market are to blame for the predicted weakness in the U.S. economy.
At the moment, the only thing that's really driving U.S. growth is government spending, and like especially military spending, which has increased substantially, and consumption, which is also probably unsustainable given the fact that a lot of it is deficit financed. So there's a superficial sense in which the U.S. economy is outperforming the rest of the world, but I think there's a lot of reason to be concerned that that's not going to be sustainable.
We've had a few weeks or months of these high tariffs. What effect does that have? Anything surprising there?
Interestingly, you know, it's complicated because you saw some stimulus actually being given to the economy because people were anticipating, let's say, soybean tariffs, and they were buying forward. So China was stimulating demand for U.S. soybeans for a while. Other sectors, I think we're waiting for the shoe to drop. We've had relatively limited effect on actual trade activity so far, and in fact, it certainly hasn't helped the trade deficit. That's been increasing dramatically. So we're still awaiting the so-called U.S.-China deal, and that's reportedly under discussion, and they're trying to work out some terms. There were some reports on expectations being raised in the last couple weeks about some accommodation being made by China to some of the U.S. demands, but China is going to be reluctant to really give in to a lot of the more extreme versions of what the U.S. is asking for, and that so it remains to be determined how much conciliation there'll be on both sides in trade. Anyway, the main impacts have not been showing up in the GDP statistics so far. We'll just have to wait to see.
What about the price of oil? Everybody seems shocked that the price of oil has declined so rapidly.
Trump administration was hoping for the Saudis to be expanding oil production and the Iranian sanctions to go into effect and basically offsetting each other. But so far, we've seen oil prices being mainly affected by the level of production of alternative energy sources like fracking. So that seems to be more expansive than anyone expected. And so oil prices have lately come down a bit. It may reverse if there's any kind of increased tensions in the Middle East. So, but basically, you know, the Saudis have not been responsible for increasing oil production so far. They've been dealing with their MBS crisis. And, you know, Trump was just on today talking about how, you know, the Saudi jobs that they were being created in the U.S. economy were just too important for us to sacrifice by putting pressure on the crown prince to resign over his murderous activities. The fact is that actual Saudi jobs being created in the U.S. economies, the notion of the Saudis creating jobs with their oil prices or their weapons purchases is pretty ridiculous.
Henry adds that the Trump tax cuts implemented last year are further dividing Americans between the haves and the have-nots. Henry says the big tech companies are running out of ideas as they plow billions from their tax windfall into enriching their own executives. He adds that's the real reason Trump didn't run on the economy during the run-up to the midterm elections.
The evidence is in this. Just this last week, we saw some reports on what U.S. companies have actually been doing with the gigantic giveaway. Basically, as of last year, they were given this enormously lucrative tax break on the $2.6 trillion they had offshore. When you looked, again, under the covers, it was not a 15% tax that they would be charged to repatriate all this money they'd accumulated tax-free offshore, but effectively a 1% tax, because they didn't really have to bring the money back. There's a territorial tax on the income it generates offshore after this year, so it's really tax-free. They had 8 years to pay the 15% repatriation tax, and they didn't actually have to reinvest it. It's a gigantic boondoggle and worth something like $600 to $800 billion to U.S. companies. So the evidence now is that they're basically not investing that money, as we expected. They have been actually investing it in stock buybacks, which is probably the lowest form of corporate executive behavior that you can indulge in. It's a real sign of being kind of out of ideas. And so you had Apple, for example, has increased their investment by about $14 billion this year, but they increased their stock buybacks by $64 billion. When companies are investing in stock buyback, basically you're seeing senior management, which gets about 80% of compensation in the form of short-term stock performance, just serving its own interest and those of the insiders on the corporate board and the shareholders who are there, as opposed to, you know, the workers and the community and the people who are wanting to see productive corporate investment and are relying on companies to come up with wise, real investment decisions. That's not what's been done. And this tax bill had absolutely no requirements for any investment to be undertaken with the $2.6 trillion that was going to be repatriated in order to get the tax breaks.
What do you mean by repatriation?
The deal under the old regime with the U.S. corporate income tax was it was a worldwide tax on corporate profits, but as long as profits were kept offshore and not brought back, they remained tax-free. And so that enticed a lot of companies like Apple and Google and Microsoft to park their intellectual property assets like patents and software and trademarks in places like Ireland, where they weren't taxable anywhere. And then they could just stockpile the money offshore. If they needed access to it, they would borrow against it. But over time, over about a 20-year period, this accumulated so that the top 100 companies had about $2.6 trillion stashed offshore. And then the idea of the tax cut was that Trump and Goldman came up with the idea of if they brought the money back, they would only be taxed not at the 35% traditional rate that was in place when they put the money offshore, but at a 15%, 15.5% typical rate. In fact, because they were given 8 years interest-free to repay that tax, it actually ends up, when you look at the numbers, that the effective rate of taxation on all that money is more like 1% to 2%. So enormous tax giveaway, unconditioned on any kind of investment in the real economy. And we've seen in this latest election, November, most Americans really understood that. You had 54% of voters across the board, both parties and independents, saying that they thought the tax cut that Trump enacted was not of any benefit to them personally, that it mainly went to the top 1%. And that was really the case. So Trump, you notice that Trump's campaign stopped talking about the tax cuts, and most congressional Republicans who were running for re-election or new seats were silent about it. They just stopped mentioning the state of the benefits of the tax bill because there weren't any.
James Henry is an economist and investigative reporter. He specializes in taxes. As May's deal looks increasingly likely to be voted down in the Commons, supporters of a second referendum are stepping up their campaign to convince MPs, those are members of Parliament, to agree to put the issue back to the people. The People's Vote campaign said it now had more than 170 groups in every region with constituency activity, ensuring that the MPs get a clear message. And finally, one protester was killed and 227 other people were injured, 8 seriously, at roadblocks set up around villages, towns, and cities across France on Saturday as citizens angry with rising fuel taxes rose up in a grassroots movement, posing a new challenge to beleaguered President Emmanuel Macron. Police officers lobbed tear gas canisters at demonstrators on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue in Paris as groups of yellow jackets, as the protesters called themselves, tried to make their way to the presidential palace. Later, hundreds of protesters entered the bottom of the street dotted with luxury shops where the palace is located and where Macron lives, before being pushed back by security forces with shields. The protester who died, a 63-year-old woman, was killed when a driver caught in the blockade accelerated in a panic in eastern France. According to the prefect or top state official in the region, a confrontation of protesters got heated up for no reason, and the driver accelerated her minivan after people started rattling her car. And that's some of the news for Saturday, November 17th, 2018. The news was engineered by James Ursay for the WBAI Evening News. I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.